This is Functional Medicine Update for August 2001, Volume 21, Number 8. This month we continue our theme of functional aging with a focus on clinical nutrition and gastroenterology. We begin on Side 1 with an update on degenerative joint disease, followed by a series of items on the topic of insulin management. These include reports on COX2 inhibitors and gastropathy, the role of glucosamine sulfate in tissue health, preventing type 2 diabetes in subjects with impaired glucose tolerance, alpha-lipoic acid in glucose transport, and APOE4 antioxidant stress. Our interview on Side 2 will be with Dr. Khursheed Jijiboy, highly respected researcher of clinical nutrition and gastroenterology. We will complete this month's FMU with an extensive report on C-reactive protein as a predictor of cardiovascular risk. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the August 2001 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
We're once again very pleased that we will be bringing to you a Clinician of the Month this month that I believe really exemplifies the whole future of where medicine is going in the 21st century and how nutrition will play an ever-increasing role in its application as we develop a functionally based medicine. And for those of you who are very gastrointestinally inclined, you'll be very pleased to know that the focus of this month's Functional Medicine Update is on functional gastroenterology and its relationship to inflammatory conditions and immune dysfunction. Before we, however, jump into the gastrointestinal components of this month's discussion, I'd like to first talk about an area that has, I think, become more clear in its mechanism of action, and historical perspective might be in order to show its context as it relates to the evolution of functional medicine. And this is the use of glucosamine sulfate in the management of osteoarthritis like degenerative joint disease. As you might recall, if we could go back but just a few years ago, the traditional medicine view of the use of glucosamine sulfate as a nutritional supplement for the modification and amelioration of osteoarthritic degenerative joint disease symptoms was that of not to be suggested, anecdote, no good science, and would be considered to be outside the bounds of conventional medicine. I think if we take a window 2001 August vision, however, a different perspective might emerge to this view. This is reflective of the change that we're seeing within medicine at large and how I think a biologically based functional medicine is emerging from this discussion. As you know, the goal of pharmacological treatment for degenerative joint disease, osteoarthritis, is to control symptoms of the disease, pain, and limitation of function that occurs with the disease. These are traditionally accomplished by the use of analgesic agents such as nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, or corticosteroid-like medications. However, the second goal of treatment obviously is to lead to the remediation and hopefully even cessation of the mechanism that leads to the etiology of the disease, and maybe even recovery and healing from that condition. Drugs for the treatment of osteoarthritis have been classified as symptom-modifying drugs, the so-called NSAIDs, and there are also the potential of structure-modifying drugs. However, the more common NSAIDs are not structure-modifying drugs. They rather are truly just symptom-modifying medications. No drug can be included in the category of joint structure favorably modifying medications that actually interfere favorably with the progression of the disease. And although we have seen major advances being made with the release of the selective cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitors, COX-2 inhibitor drugs, these, which may reduce the risk of gastropathy, still do not have any evidence indicating that they actually lead to the healing of the lesions that produce the degenerative changes associated with osteoarthritis. Thus, the compounds that we call NSAIDs might favorably affect joint damage in terms of pain and disability, but not effectively influence the mechanism of action that goes on to create the cumulative chronic degeneration of the joint. Well, that leads us obviously then to ask the question about these selective COX2 inhibitors, which have become one of the most dominant families of prescribed medicine within the last 2 years. They have been, quote, blockbuster, end quote, in their acceptance through direct-to-consumer advertising and through doctors' prescriptions. We're told that these are selective and prevent inflammatory conditions of the gut that are associated with traditional non-selective COX-2 inhibitors, like rather inexpensive medications such as ibuprofen or indomethacin. These drugs, we're told, block both cyclooxygenase 1 and cyclooxygenase 2 isoforms. The cyclooxygenase 1 isoform, you recall, is the constitutive isoform, which is very important for maintenance of mucosal integrity and immune defense of the mucosa, and therefore prevention of its injury. The inducible cyclooxygenase 2 isoform, however, we've told, is an upregulatable isoform that's associated with an inflammatory mediation and can lead to systemic injury related to accentuation of the inflammatory cascade, but its downregulation is not necessarily going to adversely affect the gastrointestinal integrity. So the desire was to form a drug that could selectively block the inducible form of cyclooxygenase, cyclooxygenase 2, without influencing the constitutive form, that's the immunoprotective isoform, cyclooxygenase 1. The first drug of this type to be approved for market use was Celebrex. And as you recall, Celebrex gained great attention and enthusiasm, particularly after the previous year and a half where there had been consumer education programs that had been put into the media to educate the consumer about the potential risk to gastropathy from traditional non-steroidals. It is ironic to note, however, that these public education programs were very coincidentally released just to be coincident with the pre-market approval of the selective COX-2 inhibiting drugs. And in fact, if you go back and examine the funding for these studies that were published in journals like that of the Annals of Medicine, you'll find that the funders for these researches were the same companies that ultimately had the patents on these selective COX-2 inhibitors. So I would call this a pretty good marketing approach, which was to first inform consumers and physicians as to the danger of the nonspecific anti-inflammatory drugs of the NSAID family, and then to come out very soon thereafter with these supposed selective COX-2 inhibitors, thereby building a concern about gastropathy, with the earliest warning signs, as you know, for most patients being internal bleeding, mucosal bleeding requiring emergency room visit and hospitalization. And therefore, the risk is real, the concern is real, but it's interesting to note, after many years of the use of these medications, that the public education about this risk only came coincident with the pre-market approval for these medications that were supposedly going to protect against gastropathy. Well, what's been the history now in the succeeding 2 years since these medications have been on the market? Have they, in fact, been the selective COX-2 inhibitors as they have been sold to the public? And have they necessarily prevented gastropathy? Well, I think we can certainly say that they are more selective than are the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen and indomethacin and ketoprofen. But I don't think we should jump to the conclusion that they are exclusively selective, as many consumers from the D2C advertising that they've been exposed to might believe. In fact, in a recent FDA action, the United States Food and Drug Administration has asked the manufacturer marketer of the medication Celebrex Pharmacia to send a regulatory letter out to all of its doctor customers informing them that they should be cautious about the potential gastropathy that could be induced in some patients from Celebrex. I will read from that recent April 2001 article that has been sent to physicians by Pharmacia in case you're unfamiliar with it. And I quote, "The FDA has objected to claims and promotional activities by or on behalf of Pharmacia that minimize the potentially serious risk of significant bleeding associated with the concomitant use of Celebrex and warfarin, anticoagulant. Additionally, the FDA has objected to claims and promotional activities that, quote, minimize the contraindication of Celebrex in patients who have demonstrated allergic-type reactions to sulfonamides, omitted important risk information, promoted Celebrex for unapproved uses, and made unsubstantiated comparative claims. Therefore, the FDA has requested that we correct these promotional messages accordingly with the following statements. Number one, in post-marketing experience, bleeding events have been reported, predominantly in the elderly, and associated with increases in prothrombin time in patients receiving Celebrex concurrently with warfarin. Therefore, anticoagulant activity should be monitored, particularly in the first few days after initiating or changing Celebrex therapy in patients receiving warfarin or similar agents. Number two, serious gastrointestinal toxicity such as bleeding, ulceration, or perforation of the stomach and small intestine or large intestine can occur at any time with or without warning signs in patients treated with Celebrex. Number three, Celebrex is contraindicated in patients who have demonstrated allergic-type reactions to sulfonamides. And number four, Celebrex is contraindicated in patients who have experienced asthma, urticaria, or allergic-type reactions after taking aspirin or other NSAIDs. Number five, Celebrex is not approved for the treatment of acute pain. It's indicated for osteoarthritis and adult rheumatoid arthritis pain. And lastly, the comparative safety of Celebrex and other selective COX2 inhibitors have not been determined. Celebrex has produced improvement in the signs and symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis comparable to the improvements produced by naproxen. End quote. That was directly taken from the letter provided to physicians from Pharmacia Corporation in response to the concern by the FDA of misleading information around the safety profile of Celebrex. Now, it's interesting to note that this class of drugs, the selective COX2 inhibitors in the last 2 years, have become one of the dominant families of drugs, and in fact, their expense may be virtually bankrupting many of the world's disease care delivery systems and reimbursement systems. Why am I saying that? Well, recently when I was in Australia, I happened to pick up a Sunday Sun Herald editorial in the June 10, 2001 issue entitled, "The Pill That Could Break Medicare." Celebrex seemed like a godsend for those with arthritis, but now it could break the Medicare bank, goes on Catherine Shine in this article to talk about the financial fallout from Celebrex. As you know, we went from a reasonably inexpensive series of NSAIDs whose price was to the patient or the provider less than a dollar a day to a medication in Celebrex or Vioxx that are three or more times as expensive, under the assumption that these would be safer, more effective, and efficient for the healthcare delivery system. This article, The Pill That Could Break Medicare, raises this question very strongly into some scrutiny. It might have seemed like a win-win situation, goes on the article to say, when the federal government agreed to subsidize the cost of the new arthritis drug Celebrex. The hundreds of thousands of Australians who suffer chronic arthritis pain were delighted they would save at least $40 for each script by having them covered under the health plan. However, since this has occurred, the increasing cost then to the healthcare system by this very expensive series of drugs has virtually burdened the system to bankruptcy. Now, we might ask, where did the consumer have their interest buoyed for the excitement about these medications? And why were they so excited? Were they not so excited because direct-to-consumer advertising got them to believe that these were safe and effective and prevented the potential risk to gastropathy and serious intestinal bleeding that could occur with the less expensive compounds that could be available over the counter, such as ibuprofen drugs? Well, that's a question that I obviously will leave for your imagination, but I think that we certainly are recognizing that the subliminal seduction of consumers by direct-to-consumer advertising for pharmaceuticals has at least contributed to the rising interest in these, quote, new drugs with high expense under the presumption that they're more safe and more effective. But do they really deliver the goods? And in the case of Celebrex, even if it didn't have gastropathy as one of the side effects or nephropathy as one of the side effects, the question of its efficacy would still be raised because although it may lower the symptom, pain and disability, its effect on the disease process itself and the degeneration of connective tissue is insensitive to the medication. In other words, it does not influence the primary disease process. So again, we come back then to the, quote, anecdote and non-scientific suggestion that glucosamine might be a medication or a nutritional supplement or a nutraceutical or a food concentrate or whatever you'd like to term it that could not only influence the actual signs and symptoms of disability of degenerative joint disease, but might also lead to healing of joint-based lubricant substances, the complex sulfated mucopolysaccharides. And then, of course, I'm now leading to the paper that was published recently in The Lancet, volume 357, page 251 in 2001, that most of you are familiar with. Just as a reminder, this is the paper that was entitled Long-Term Effects of Glucosamine Sulfate on Osteoarthritis Progression, a Randomized Placebo-Controlled Trial. In this study, 212 patients were broken into two groups. These were patients that had all shown knee osteoarthritis and degenerative changes. They were randomly assigned half into a placebo group and half into a treatment group, the treatment group getting 1,500 milligrams of glucosamine sulfate orally daily for 3 years. The findings were quite remarkable. The 106 patients on placebo had a progressive joint space narrowing, meaning the disease continued, with a mean joint space loss after 3 years of about 0.3 millimeters, whereas there was no significant joint space loss in 106 patients on glucosamine sulfate. As assessed by various types of scoring and rating scales, symptoms worsened slightly in patients on placebo compared with the improvement observed after treatment with glucosamine sulfate. There were no differences in safety between the placebo group or the glucosamine sulfate group. Well, this is very interesting, isn't it, when you look at the results of this trial? And in fact, they go on to say in the conclusion, the long-term combined structure-modifying and symptom-modifying effects of glucosamine sulfate suggest it could be a disease-modifying agent in osteoarthritis, in quote, which is very different than what we can hope for from the selective COX2 inhibitors, which are, at best, improving symptoms with a slightly lowered risk to gastropathy, but are not necessarily improving the actual course of the degenerative condition in the joint. Glucosamine sulfate, as you know, is the sulfate derivative of the natural aminosaccharide glucosamine. Glucosamine is a normal constituent of glycosaminoglycans and cartilage matrix and synovial fluid as joint space lubricant substance, and it can have various pharmacological actions in articular cartilage and joint tissues to both help improve connective tissue and joint space lubricant composition, thereby leading to the healing of the lesion, not just the symptom modification of the inflammation. Well, there are more studies that are now being published since the clinical placebo-controlled trial. One recent paper that I'm very excited about appeared in Arthritis and Rheumatism, Volume 44, page 1089 in 2001, entitled Preferential Incorporation of Glucosamine into the Galactosamine Moieties of Chondroitin Sulfates in Articular Cartilage Explants. In this paper, the investigators are attempting to find a mechanism by which glucosamine sulfate might have advantage in both the reduction of symptoms and the repair of damaged tissue in individuals with degenerative joint disease. Therefore, the objective was to determine the metabolic fate of orally administered glucosamine in intact articular cartilage tissue. I want to emphasize this is an ex vivo study done in animal tissues, but I think its model is applicable, obviously, to understanding of how glucosamine sulfate may work in human osteoarthritis as well. It was found that glucosamine was taken up by the chondrocyte and incorporated selectively into hexosamine, but not into hexuronic acid. Hexosamine is a component of the glycosaminoglycan chain of articular cartilage, the so-called proteoglycans, and this demonstrates that glucosamine is a substrate of choice for galactosamine moieties of the chondroitin sulfate, incorporating at levels 300% higher than those of an equivalent amount of galactose or galactosamine. So it's a very preferentially taken up, conditionally essential nutrient, so to speak. And the results indicate that glucosamine facilitates the production of proteoglycan components that are synthesized through the hexosamine biochemical pathway and help then in reconstruction of the connective tissue as well as the joint lubricant. Now you might ask the question, obviously, does that mean that glucosamine is a nutrient? And I just said a moment ago, it may be a conditionally essential nutrient. In most individuals of young age, glucosamine as a matrix material may be adequately available for incorporation within the chondrocyte synthesis of the proteoglycans, so it's already being made at adequate concentrations by the body, so-called biosynthesized, and would not be considered, therefore, an essential nutrient. But, however, and this is a very important however, as we age, as we're under trauma, as we have a localized degenerative process going on, the ability of the body to synthesize that material at levels of need may be lower than that of need, and therefore it becomes what we call a conditionally essential nutrient. For that individual, augmented levels beyond that which they can biosynthesize by their own genetically preprogrammed process may be necessary for optimal function. And this is why I think the term functional medicine, functional nutrition, or functional genomics is being redefined as we move into the 21st century around a personalized preventive medical perspective away from a rehabilitative perspective of older age individuals who have dysfunctional capabilities, and functional medicine is more rehabilitative medicine in its spin from the 20th century. I think the 21st century what we're going to see is functional medicine has a spin on the word, a definition to the word that relates really to the translation of our genetic pluripotentiality into phenotypic function, this genotype-phenotype conversion of which the environment plays an important role in the expression stimulus. And in this case, what we're saying is people with degenerative joint changes who may be candidates for selective COX-2 inhibitor drugs because of the symptoms that they've had, the warning signs of inflammation, may benefit from 1,200 milligrams a day of glucosamine sulfate because it not only lowers over the course of several months the pain indices and disability indices, but it also increases the body's synthesis of these proteoglycan materials that leads to a healing of the lesions and recovery from the fundamental process that leads to the disease. So I would use this as a very interesting, specific example of how the tide is changing, that we're stepping across a threshold in medicine that is happening maybe subtly, but it's happening very profoundly. As these papers get into the literature and as they define a new way that the body works as it ages and new needs that go beyond the recommended dietary allowance for specific substances to then augment biochemical function, that will open the door for a functionally based medicine. And by the way, this is so compatible with the model of Linus Pauling, the orthomolecular medicine model that he published in a landmark paper in Science magazine back in 1967, an article that was considered by most of his medical colleagues to be artifactual, to be not pertinent to clinical medicine, to be very theoretic about mass action effects and about enzyme kinetics and about pushing sluggish equilibria by increasing substrate concentrations. And these were things that the average practicing physician thought were way outside the bounds of what they would ever be interested in managing a patient with an age-related disorder. But now what we're seeing is this is the language of the 21st century of medicine. This is how we're going to personalize medicine and make it applicable not just to the 70-kilogram white Anglo-Saxon Protestant average individual, but rather to the individual's own specific book of life. There are 23 pairs of chromosomes, the chapters in their book of life. Well, let's take the same theme and move it to the next level, the level that we've heard spoken to quite a bit this last 12 months in Functional Medicine Update, and I'm sure it will continue to be a theme because it's so important, and that's insulin management, and its influence on gene expression and ultimate age-related diseases. Dr. Gerald Reaven did a tremendous job at our symposium, the 8th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, helping update us as it relates to what's happening with insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. We've had a wonderful Functional Medicine Update Clinician of the Month with Dr. Schwartzbein, as well as Dr. Reaven over the last 12 months, talking about dietary modification of the insulin resistance situation. And then more recently, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, we see a paper that is so strongly functional medicine that it just speaks in volumes about what this program over the last nearly 20 years has been speaking to. And the title of this paper is Relation of Impaired Fasting and Post-Load Glucose with Incident Type 2 Diabetes in a Dutch Population. This was in the Journal of American Medical Association, Volume 285, page 2109 in the year 2001. And, you know, it is just profound when we read this to think about how the context of medicine is changing with these types of studies being published. The study basically was to look at individuals with impaired glucose tolerance or impaired fasting glucose. It was, in a sense, a comparison between the World Health Organization criteria for disinsulinism and dysglycemia and the American Diabetics Association criteria for establishing dysglycemia. As you probably recall, we had a revision of the criteria to establish the diagnosis of diabetes and impaired glucose tolerance last year, the year 2000, with the ADA doing away with the suggestion that there was a value from doing the oral glucose tolerance test and relying solely on a new refined, tighter blood sugar fasting glucose criteria. The World Health Organization criteria, however, has utilized both the fasting blood sugar as well as fasting insulin and the results from a two-hour postprandial oral glucose tolerance test. And so the question might be raised, is there any value from going this extra step, which is costly and to the patient more demanding, which is to do a two-hour postprandial oral glucose tolerance or an insulin tolerance test after a 75-gram glucose load? Well, some people might consider that overutilization of medical services and expending necessary resources in a very frivolous and non-useful way. So what does this paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association tell us about the difference between impaired fasting glucose and impaired glucose tolerance after an oral glucose challenge? Well, here are the data. This was a study, by the way, population-based cohort study conducted from October 89 to February 92 among 1,342 non-diabetic white residents in the Netherlands aged 50 to 75 years of age in whom fasting glucose concentrations and glucose 2 hours after a 75-gram glucose tolerance test were measured at baseline and follow-up some 4 years to 8 years later in 1996 to 1998. So asking the question, how many of these people that had impairments in their fasting blood sugar or their postprandial blood glucose after a 75-gram glucose load ultimately went on to get diabetes? Was there a differentiation? So here's the data. The cumulative indices of diabetes was 6.1%, 8.3%, and 9.9% according to the World Health Organization 1985, the American Diabetics Association, and the World Health Organization 1999 criteria, respectively. Remember, the ADA criteria is that which does not suggest the use of the 2-hour postprandial sugar, whereas the World Health Organization does. And the difference was 8.3% versus 9.9%. However, let's go on a little more fully and look at the data. The cumulative incidence of diabetes, this is the WHO 1999 criteria, for participants with both impaired fasting glucose and impaired glucose tolerance was 64.5%. compared with 4.5% for those with normal glucose levels at baseline that would have been picked up by the ADA, the American Diabetics Association criterion. Let me say that again. The participants that had a combination of both impaired fasting sugar, meaning elevated blood sugar on fasting, and impaired glucose tolerance, meaning you would have to do the 75-gram load test, was 64.5% compared with 4.5% for those who had just looked at glucose fasting levels alone. The odds ratio for diabetes, according to the WHO 1999 criteria, adjusted for age, sex, and follow-up duration, were 10 and 39, respectively, for those having isolated impaired fasting glucose or impaired glucose tolerance, and when they had both fasting glucose and glucose tolerance impaired, as I said, the ratio went up to 39.5, the risk, relative risk. So the study, it shows that the cumulative incidence of diabetes was strongly related to both fasting blood sugar impairment and impaired glucose tolerance at 2 hours, and that the presence of both of those factors together gave a much more sensitive marker for later stage incidence of diabetes. Again, I want to emphasize looking at functional markers and the impaired glucose tolerance is a functional marker. We're stressing the system with an oral glucose load, and we're looking at the ability of the system to accommodate that stress. And what we're saying is the lack of organ reserve in an individual who is disinsulin in their response will be seen as an aberration in their both postprandial insulin and postprandial glucose that we call impaired glucose and impaired insulin management, disinsulinism, hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, which is a much more strong predictor of cardiovascular disease and of potential risk to diabetes and other factors than just utilizing fasting blood sugar alone. Now, with that in mind, once we've got that assessed and we've got that functional abnormality understood in the patient, then what do we do about it? It's only halfway there if we just understand it. We have to then ask, how do we modify that relative uniqueness through the genotype-phenotype connection? And that leads to the second paper, New England Journal of Medicine, volume 344, page 1343 in the year 2001. Another powerful paper back-to-back, Prevention of Type 2 Diabetes by Changes in Lifestyle Among Subjects with Impaired Glucose Tolerance. So these were individuals who had both impaired glucose tolerance and had normal to slightly elevated fasting blood sugars. So they were maturity onset, kind of insulin-resistant, hyperinsulinemic individuals in the main, and would not be considered, I guess, in the stage of fulminant diabetes, type 2 maturity onset diabetes, but certainly that which we would have picked up by a 2-hour postprandial insulin and glucose evaluation. In this study, 522 middle-aged overweight subjects, 172 men and 350 women, mean age of 55 years, with a mean body mass index that was quite elevated. Remember, we said that any BMI that's above about 26, 27 would be considered obesity, and the mean in this group was 31. They had impaired glucose tolerance, which was measured again by the oral glucose tolerance test. Each subject was then assigned to a intervention group in which they got either the standard diet and standard information or individualized counseling aimed at reducing weight, total fat intake, and intake of saturated fat, and increasing intake of fiber as well as regular physical activity. An oral glucose tolerance test was performed annually in this test. Diagnosis of diabetes was confirmed by a second test. The mean duration of follow-up was about 3.2 years in the study. The result was quite remarkable in that individuals who fell into the criteria of impaired glucose tolerance through the glucose tolerance test and would later become diabetic could have modification of the progression of this condition into diabetes by selective lifestyle intervention using diet and exercise. And they conclude in this paper that type 2 diabetes can be prevented by changes in the lifestyles of high-risk subjects as determined, I might add, parenthetically, by the fasting blood sugar in combination with the glucose tolerance test, a functional test. Now, this is exactly what Dr. Reeven told us just 2 months ago in our Functional Medicine Update Clinician of the Month interview. He told us that by modifying the specific nature of the signals that go to the genes that control then glucose transport through lowered saturated fat intake, increased micronutrient density of the diet, lowered simple carbohydrate, and regular activity, that one can signal a different function through things like the peroxisome proliferated activated receptor alpha and gamma, which then has a regulatory effect on mitochondrial function and crosstalks with insulin and has an influence then on protein tyrosine kinase expression and cell effects that ultimately control not only glucose transport, but a variety of other cellular personalities that lead to inflammation, maybe adipocyte hypertrophy, which then causes fat accumulation, changing triglyceride storage, all these various things that we associate then with the metabolic syndrome. So it's a very, very powerful example of where we would say, well, yes, diet and exercise euphemistically on some broad public health level influences individual risk factors of diabetes. No, what we're saying here is that personalized genetic uniqueness and expression into the phenotype, as can be exposed functionally by doing an oral glucose tolerance test, then allows us to laser in and specify what patient is most sensitive or will have the highest clinical outcome, the highest evidence-based response to this type of a diet intervention therapy. So it's a very interesting transition in medicine from the diagnosis of the average, of where we've gone from medical taxonomy, which is the nature of the game, to now looking at the definition of the metabolic underpinnings of the condition and personalizing the intervention to that person's individual's need. So could hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance then be one of the missing links that ties together metabolism, genetic expression, diet, environment with age-related diseases? Because we know that not only is diabetes a risk factor for hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance, we know that cardiovascular disease is associated with hyperinsulinemia. We know that malignancy, we know that irritable bowel or inflammatory bowel disease associated with hyperinsulinemia, we know that inflammatory conditions of joints and other tissues is associated with insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia. So could it be a central feature in aging or age-related diseases? A modifiable risk factor of biological aging, I might add. Well, none other than Gerald Reeven is a co-author in a recent paper to that topic in Free Radical Biology and Medicine, Volume 29, page 1302, in which they talk about hyperinsulinemia and call it the missing link among oxidative stress and age-related diseases. And they point out that there's mounting evidence for Denham-Harmon's hypothesis that one feature of biological aging, or accelerated biological aging, is free radical oxidative reactions, and that these free radicals and the relationship to oxidative stress create then cellular damage. In diabetes, it can lead to the damage of the eyes or the nerves or the kidneys we associate with the secondary side effects of diabetes. It is now recognized that hyperinsulinemia may also have functions beyond that of the secondary side effects of diabetes that promote aging, and these may be independent of the elevations of blood sugar itself. That insulin itself, when high in tissues or in plasma, influences gene expression in such a way as to increase the messengers of alarm, The alarm messengers are those that are associated with what we call cytokines or inflammatory processes that then cut across things like metastatic injuries, cut across inflammatory problems, and coronary heart disease. Hyperinsulinemia then, by its effects on the inflammatory process and on antioxidative enzyme system and free radical generation, could enhance oxidative stress, and that this could serve then as a pro-aging phenomena. It might also explain why calorie restriction in part lowers the rate of biological aging in animals. By lowering insulin flux by calorie restriction, one might then get increased regulation of oxidative metabolism and lowered messages to the genes of inflammation. So again, I think Reuven is right on the point talking about, do we see a convergence of various mechanisms of which insulin plays a part of the role? And we'll come back to talk about this with our clinician of the month this month on side two of the tape. How do you modify then the signals of insulin that is producing some of these untoward phenotypic expressions? That's a good question. Obviously, we talk about dietary modification. We talk about exercise with the GLUT4 receptors translocating to the cellular membrane, so more glucose can be transported across the cellular membrane with a more efficient energy economy of the cell. These are all things that we've discussed in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update, and Dr. Reuven alluded to in his eloquent presentation, as did several of our other clinicians who have really focused on this insulin, protein, carbohydrate, metabolism connection. Dr. Schwartzbein certainly did a superb job in giving us the kind of metabolic story, as Dr. Bill Evans did, with talking about the biochemistry of exercise and its relationship to insulin sensitivity. There's a nutrient, however, that we've also explored in previous issues. Dr. Bert Berkson talked about this nutrient some time ago as a clinician of the month in Functional Medicine Update, and he talked about it as a liver protector, a hepatoprotectant nutrient for hepatotoxicity, hepatitis, and toxins like Amanita, the death cap mushroom, and how we could protect against liver toxicity. And that was lipoic acid and N-acetylcysteine, but lipoic acid playing a very important role. We recognize now that lipoic acid is more than just a hepatoprotectant against hepatotoxic injury and oxidative stress. It also has a very important role to play in increasing or improving insulin signaling and reducing the dysfunction that occurs in hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance. This was recently described in a wonderful animal study published in Free Radical Biology and Medicine, Volume 30, page 383 in 2001, in which they evaluated the role that alpha-lipoic acid, or ALA, alpha-lipoic acid, has on stimulating glucose transport and enhancing the process by which insulin works in skeletal muscle from insulin-resistant animals. And they showed that therapeutic administration of alpha-lipoic acid both improved glucose transport and improved insulin signaling pathways. The findings suggest that the cellular mode of action of alpha-lipoic acid is restricted then to signaling factors that are unique to the activation of glucose transport. This may explain why this nutritional agent is used therapeutically in Europe as a diabetogenic compound to treat diabetes, an anti-diabetic agent. And as a consequence, the 200, 400, 600 milligram per day, sometimes as high as 1,000 milligram per day, alpha-lipoic acid supplementation of individuals with frank hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, with a elevated triglyceride and a reduced HDL level, the hallmarks of insulin resistance and syndrome X, metabolic syndrome, may produce a very favorable outcome in that person as it relates to gene expression and the regulation of glucose transport. So again, I think of one agent that we have focused quite a bit of discussion on as it relates to antioxidant effects, which is alpha-lipoic acid. We should also think of it as an insulin modulating substance, and in humans, generally doses can be graded up from 200 to as high as 600 or more milligrams per day. I encourage once again, however, that the use of alpha-lipoic acid in insulin-resistant, hyperinsulinemic individuals be done cautiously, because if a person has a very high level of plasma insulin and you stimulate insulin action too quickly, you can get a hypoglycemic response. So I generally suggest starting at a lower dose and grading up to the dose that matches or titrates against that particular person's glucose and insulin needs. I might also add parenthetically that the waist-to-hip ratio can be a useful anthropometric tool for evaluating patients who may be at risk to insulin resistance, along with the fasting triglyceride and HDL ratio. If the fasting triglyceride HDL ratio is increased greater than 5 to 1, then we would suggest that that is a strong indicator of the potential for insulin resistance. And if the person has an increased waist-to-hip ratio, that also tracks back against impairments in 2-hour postprandial glucose and insulin levels. That was actually shown in the paper that I described earlier in the Journal of the American Medical Association. When an individual is shifted towards this process of insulin resistance and poor oxidative phosphorylation and more anaerobic glycolysis to produce energy because they're not getting a proper oxidative breakdown of glucose in the mitochondria, then what they're also doing is producing more oxidants, more oxidative stress occurs, and the oxidative stress leads to the damage to unsaturated lipids. These could be unsaturated lipids in the plasma, or they could be unsaturated lipids in the membranes of cells. The damage to these lipids produces a byproduct called malonaldehyde or malondialdehyde. Malondialdehyde is a substance, a very small molecule, which reacts with proteins very rapidly to form shifts bases by the amino groups of lysyl residues and proteins like plasma proteins or membrane-bound proteins, translocated proteins. The combination of this lipid peroxidation byproduct, we might call rancidity product of lipids, that comes from free radical oxidation associated with dysglycemia, then causes damaged proteins. Now, these damaged proteins, these shift-based proteins, then you might ask, are they seen as the body as funny proteins? And does the body become allergic to itself as a consequence of cross-reacting with these malondialdehyde-modified proteins? And that was recently reviewed and published in Free Radical Biology and Medicine, Volume 30, page 277 in the year 2001, in which it was shown that circulating antibodies that recognize malondialdehyde-modified proteins are found in healthy subjects, and the higher the level of oxidative stress and the higher the disinsulinism and dysglycemia, then the more malonaldehyde produced, the more damaged proteins, the higher the titer to these proteins, and the more likelihood of cross-reactivity of the immune system then producing an inflammatory cascade. So this may be why we see immune-like dysfunctions in diabetics and individuals with disinsulinism, because we start building higher titers not only of the glycosylated proteins, but also of the malonaldehyde-linked proteins. So you might say, well, I don't see elevated fructosamine in my patients, so gee whiz, I don't have a frank dysglycemia going on, and I don't see a lot of elevated glycohemoglobin, so they don't have a lot of glucose reacting with hemoglobin protein, so I probably don't have to worry about the immune system being activated. But are we looking at the byproducts of lipid oxidation, the malonaldehyde, which comes from free radical damage? Because it may be that this particular process is leading to an antibody against these malonaldehyde-modified proteins, these shift bases, that then create some of the immunological effects. So a combination of glycated proteins, the so-called advanced glycosylation end products, or AGEs, aged proteins, in combination with malonaldehyde-modified proteins from oxidative stress, from uncoupling of mitochondria and disinsulinism, gives rise to a kind of a double-barreled risk to immune dysfunction. So by improving insulin stimulation and insulin signaling and glucose transport, we can have effects across many organ systems and many subspecialties of medicine, I might add, cardiology, diabetology, rheumatology, gastroenterology, oncology, neurology. All of these ologies are in part related to dysfunctions in this insulin signaling and glucoregulatory pathway. A very interesting another example of the emergence of functional medicine models. Well, we might also ask, are all individuals equally susceptible to these discussions that I'm sharing with you? Or are there specific genotypes that are more susceptible to oxidative stress and more susceptible to vascular and neurological injury and more susceptible to lipid modification of the diet? And of course, that question, just to ask that question, means that we're moving into the bailiwick of a functional-based or a functional genomic-based medicine. In the past, to ask that question may have been a little superfluous because we didn't have the tools to know how to answer it. As, however, we have seen over the past 5 years, the new genomic probes and the new ways of evaluating genetic uniqueness become available through advances made in the Human Genome Project, we are then starting to see new assessment tools getting to the clinical laboratory. Homocysteine, obviously, is one of those that we've spoken to great length, but another one that's actually correlated slightly with homocysteine, which is also starting to get more on the radar screen, is the ApoE genotype. And as you recall, this lipid transport protein called ApoE, of which there is ApoA, ApoB, ApoE, different families of apolipoproteins that transport lipid to form these lipoproteins, they have different personalities and different effects on vascular endothelium and other tissues. And the ApoE genotype exists in three forms. I think you're all aware of this. We've spoken to it at great length at the previous editions of Functional Medicine Update, and that's the ApoE2, ApoE3, and ApoE4 genotypes. Recently, in Medical Hypothesis, Volume 56, page 357 in 2001, a very interesting speculative paper was written entitled Medical Utility of ApoE Allele Determination in Assessing the Need for Antioxidant Therapy. And what this author points out is that the ApoE4 allele is associated with a variety of conditions that range from Alzheimer's disease to coronary heart disease to stroke and post-operative cognitive dysfunction and also head trauma. As you know, boxers and other people who have had head trauma, like professional athletes, have a higher risk of dementia if they have an ApoE4-carrying condition. We now recognize from work that's been done that purified ApoE in vivo protects cells from hydrogen peroxide cytotoxicity and toxicity induced by beta-amyloid peptides, with ApoE2 and ApoE3 having a much higher protective ability than ApoE4. Increased levels of ApoE4 actually can result in much decreased antioxidant protection against these oxidant stress conditions. Increased levels of oxidative stress would be predicted to enhance beta-amyloid peptide deposition and may therefore be most susceptible in those who carry the E4 allele, says this article. It has been observed that plasma lipoproteins from ApoE-deficient mice are more susceptible to in vivo oxidation than lipoproteins from wild-type mice, and in addition, mice lacking ApoE are prone to atherosclerosis. Thus, it may be that the ApoE4 genotype has a significantly decreased endogenous antioxidant capacity or increased oxidation capacity than individuals who do not carry the ApoE4 allele. So the ApoE4 is a very interesting genotypic marker for oxidant stress, inflammation, and lipid sensitivity. In fact, in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 73, page 669 in the year 2001, it was shown that the ApoE4 is highly cholesterol-sensitive, more inflammatory-prone, whereas the ApoE2 is more sucrose-sensitive and more susceptible to hypertriglyceridemia and insulin resistance. And the ApoE3, which is the most common genotype in the American sandpile genes, which constitutes on the order of 50% or more of the ApoE genes, is not necessarily even cholesterol or sucrose sensitive. So the ApoE2's sucrose sensitivity and hypertriglyceridemia, the ApoE4's fat and cholesterol sensitive and oxidative stress. So you might put that on your markers for genotypic evaluation as we start looking at how to personalize therapy. With that in mind, I think we're ready to move to our clinician of the month, who is going to tell us a little bit about the evolution of this whole genomic personalization. Well, once again, we're at that portion of our Functional Medicine Update each month, and I know all of you look forward to it. It's our Clinician of the Month or Researcher of the Month segment, and we've been so pleased to have some of the historically most important pioneers in nutrition and nutritional medicine as our Clinician of the Month, and certainly the same is held this month. We have as our guest Dr. Khursheed Jijiboy, who for the last probably 20 years in my history of involvement in this field has been a real leader and person who has opened up a lot of thoughts about the role particularly trace minerals play for me in human nutrition through his work in parenteral nutrition. Dr. Jijiboy is a medical doctor, gastroenterologist, and a PhD, University of London, has extraordinary curriculum vitae, is a professor of medicine, a Department of Medicine, Department of Nutritional Sciences, as well as the Department of Physiology at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Has a publication list that is extensive across wide ranges of fields and discoveries. One of the papers that has been published out of his very long list of publications is in the Journal of Parenteral Internal Nutrition that kind of defines some of the things that we're going to be speaking about. The paper's entitled Nutritional Support in Clinical Practice, Review of Published Data and Recommendations for Future Research Directions, in which Dr. Jijiboy has given historical perspective as to how many of the, quote, essential nutrients that are now recognized as important for human nutrition have been discovered and through work that's gone on in the clinical nutrition area. And
His own work with Total Parenteral Nutrition has really opened the door to our understanding in many of these areas. So with that as a very cursory introduction, Dr. Gigi Boy, I welcome you to Functional Medicine Update. How did you get interested in nutrition, in that a lot of gastroenterologists have historically taken other routes in terms of their research interests and their focus? How did you get off on this very interesting and important area?
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be on your program. My interest in nutrition was actually quite simple. When I came as a young doctor on staff, I was given the worst patients with GI problems, and I came to rapidly realize that these really seriously sick individuals were not sick from their gastrointestinal disease, but were sick because their gut was unable to nourish them properly. So as a way of treating them, I realized that the one thing that had not been done by my colleagues was to look into their nutritional status, and that's what got me into the area of nutrition. And I think in gastrointestinal disease, what is not appreciated is that a lot of the morbidity and perhaps some of the mortality is related to malnutrition and not to the bowel itself.
I don't want to get too philosophical here, but as a leader really in gastrointestinal research and nutrition, I've always wondered, to have an opinion for someone of your stature, why it is that gastroenterology, which you would feel is a field of subspecialty medicine that might have the most interest in nutrition relative to, that's the organ which is involved with digestion and assimilation of nutrients, seems often to be so little interested in nutrition as a clinical practice.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it's mainly because of the training. Nutrition is often taught in endocrinology, and endocrinologists have been interested in nutrition. Others are hematologists. And the area of nutrition is so broad that it tends to get diffused among different subspecialties. And I suspect it is mainly because of the subspecialization that some of the difficulty arises. Secondly, the training in gastroenterology as it has evolved has either gone into the areas of intestinal function where most basic researchers have worked, or in the area of endoscopy, which is a mechanical process. And unfortunately, because of this sort of polarization, the middle ground, which is so important to lots of patients, is often forgotten, and I think that it's an area which needs a lot of development. But having said that, I may add that the American Gastroenterological Association has now recognized this. There is, in fact, a specific section of nutrition and obesity, so that they're looking at both sides of the spectrum. And we have a very active group there promoting nutrition as an important subspecialty within the area of gastroenterology.
Well, that's very exciting and very optimistic. If you could maybe for our listeners, as a historical part of what you have opened up the door to many of us, tell us a little bit about your chromium story. I think that that is a very fascinating history that I think many of our listeners may be unfamiliar with. It might be helpful for them to see how these advances in understanding are made.
That's an interesting story even for myself. As you know, when we had patients, or at least when I first started to deal with individuals who had a major part of their small intestine removed, and for your listeners who may not be familiar with it, once the small intestine has been removed, the ability to absorb nutrients is severely compromised. These patients had severe malabsorption, and we had to feed them intravenously. Well, when you feed them intravenously, you have to put the very many different elements that exist in food into a mixture. We sort of calculated that approximately there are about 42 to 43 different nutrients that are in a TPN mixture as it's given today. And when we did that, at that time, of course, I wasn't as familiar with a number of the taste-based elements as I am now. We had a patient who, after being on intravenous feeding with what we thought was a pretty complete mixture, started to get a loss of sensation in her lower limbs. She informed me that she was walking on cotton wool. And when we investigated her, I found that she was diabetic. However, the cause of diabetes was somewhat a puzzle to us because she was not an older person at that stage. She had no family history of diabetes. And in addition, the diabetes was characterized by severe injury to the nerves in her lower limbs. So that this was an unusual situation. And for about a year, I didn't quite understand what was happening. And then just by accident, I happened to read the studies by Dr. Walter Mertz and his colleagues at Beltsville in the agricultural unit there, and realized that chromium was important in insulin action, and that animals that had been made chromium deficient became metabolically diabetic. So that made me look into this patient once again, and I said, well, maybe she is chromium deficient, and indeed that's what we found, that her blood levels of chromium were reduced, and we then decided to give her some chromium. And when I wanted to do that, the pharmacist was quite confused as to how we were going to do this intravenously. But we then put together a mixture and we infused it with chromium. And we were pleasantly surprised to find that, first of all, her diabetes disappeared, and secondly, over a period of months, her nerve damage improved dramatically, not only subjectively, but also by nerve conduction studies, we showed there was marked improvement. We then realized that, in fact, she had chromium deficiency, and this was probably the first definitely published case of human chromium deficiency.
From that work, how quickly did your colleagues accept the fact that chromium was a missing essential nutrient in TPN and start to realistically consider the need for it?
Well, it was a slow process, but then what happens, like with everything else, when you have a single patient, my colleagues are somewhat more skeptical, and I don't fault them for that. I think that when you make a single observation, maybe it was, as the English term is, a flash in the pan. It wasn't maybe nothing. But then, subsequently, several other individuals noted the same thing in their patients. They became sensitized to the fact that diabetes occurring in this situation might be due to chromium deficiency. So they looked at their patients afresh, and several more publications came out showing chromium deficiency. So it got accepted, and in fact, the recommendations now of the trace element mixture contains chromium, so that once other people reproduced what we had found, this became accepted.
One of the interesting things that I often encounter when I talk to doctors about nutrition is their lack of understanding of the role that these trace and ultra-trace elements play in nutrition. I guess we've assumed that because they're in such small need that they must always come along with a standard diet. Is there any data suggesting what the biological heterogeneity of the population is relative to the needs of some of these minerals?
I think this is a very, very important question that you brought out. I think the future of nutrition is really the interaction between one's genetic makeup and the kind of diet you take. I don't think that one diet fits everybody. And it's a very important point you bring out, namely that people are heterogeneous genetically, and therefore diets and needs for nutrients might be altered. And the term I would like to introduce at this point is conditioned nutrient requirements. I'd like to slightly change the subject, but still remain in the area of micronutrients to point out what I'm talking about. If an individual eats a diet which is very rich in carbohydrates, say, eats a lot of rice, and takes absolutely no vitamin B, then they would develop severe deficiency of vitamin B. On the other hand, if they do not eat carbohydrate, that means they starve, and do not take vitamin B, they will not develop the signs of vitamin B deficiency. In other words, taking the high carbohydrate diet conditions them to an increased requirement for vitamin B, particularly thiamine. In the same way, there are individuals who are called insulin resistant, which means that when they eat a small amount of carbohydrate or any kind of energy, their insulin levels go up extremely high. These individuals do poorly when they are on high-calorie diets. They do better when they're somewhat starved, and they are the individuals that become diabetic in the long run. On the other hand, there are other individuals who are very insulin-sensitive. In other words, they can take a lot of energy and not have high insulin levels, and they can pack away large amounts of calories without having any problems. So that the requirements of a number of nutrients, whether they be macronutrients in the form of energy or micronutrients in the form of vitamins, conditioned by what you eat and what your genetic structure is. Now, having said that, there are a number of very essential nutrients, such as, for example, zinc and selenium or antioxidants, copper and chromium, and their requirements are conditioned by one's genetics. For example, there is evidence that the Hispanic population, for instance, seem to have a lot of gestational diabetes, and there are studies which indicate that in them, for example, chromium supplementation seems to be beneficial. This may not be true for others who do not have that kind of problem.
This is a fascinating part of the evolution, I think, of both nutrition and medicine, this whole functional genomics chapter that's opening up. And I believe your work has really been one of the major contributors to us understanding how some of these variabilities may play a role both in crisis critical care as well as in ambulatory care for patients. And it seems that I read a review article by Walter Mertz, the same gentleman you were speaking to earlier, related to chromium, in the Nutrition Reviews Journal, in which he was talking about the evolution of the recommended dietary allowances and how these single numbers that were put as needs for individuals may be modified as we move forward to ranges to account for these biological variabilities.
Yes, this is so-called RDA. The recommended dietary allowances is no longer acceptable. And what, in fact, these committees are looking into are upper and lower ranges, where they look at a lower figure, which is an index of what would be the floor below which you get deficiency, and then the upper figure, which might represent a level beyond which you might get some toxicity. You have to recognize that food can be both beneficial as toxic. We know if you eat a lot and become obese, that's not very good. And similarly, for a number of vitamins, a small amount is good, and very large amounts might be toxic. For example, vitamin D and vitamin A are examples of that, so that we have to identify what is the band in which the requirements have to be met. And disease modifies this band by altering absorption, by altering metabolism, and similarly genetics modifies it by making people require more or less of some of these micro and macronutrients.
Well, I want to shift, if I can, that theme slightly to move to another of the many areas that you have covered in your vast research and publication efforts, and that's in the area that I think Dr. Irvin Rosenberg calls sarcopenia, but it's body composition related to muscle mass in individuals related to aging and nutritional status. One of the many papers that you've published in this area is one that really intrigued me. It was a phosphor 31 NMR study looking at phosphocreatine recharge rates in individuals relative to their nutrition status. Can you tell us a little bit about this whole muscle mass aging connection and nutritional status? Is this a biomarker that has any value for the average clinician in following their patients? I'm not talking about P31 NMR as much as now body composition.
Well, I think there are two sides to this. My interest has been slightly different in that I've not only been interested in the composition, but the fact how well that composition works. That's really the basis of the P31 NMR studies. And to explain the sort of historical perspective here, I was impressed by the fact that patients, when they came in extremely malnourished, they lost a lot of weight, they were in a hospital, they were not moving around, and you fed them intravenously or through a tube, and very quickly they would become extremely active and feel really well. And if you really measured their muscle mass or their body composition, etc., it had changed a little bit, but hadn't changed a whole lot at that stage. That's not to say that we wouldn't like them to gain more weight and get more muscle mass. Certainly that's more beneficial. But we were impressed with the fact that even when they were very sick, if you fed them, they had a marked improvement in their performance. And that made me look into the question of muscle performance. And one of the more interesting studies we did was in patients who were anorexic, or individuals anorexic who had tremendous weight loss. They were quite wasted and so forth. And when we fed them, we found very quickly that their muscle potassium content went up, and that their ability to contract and relax their muscles improved greatly long before they had a change actually in their body mass per se. And that resulted in our looking at as to why that happened. And we used P31 NMR. Now, just to put that in perspective, phosphorus is a component of most cells as a part of the energy-producing system, which is called ATP and phosphocreatine. And muscle contracts and relaxes by receiving energy by the breakdown and resynthesis of ATP in the muscle. And using phosphorus 31 NMR, it's possible for us to follow the breakdown and the resynthesis of this particular component without actually invading the body. In other words, we didn't have to take biopsies. We just put a coil around the leg, and you could follow this process. And what we found was that malnutrition was associated with a markedly reduced rate of synthesis of ATP in muscle. I think what actually happens is that when you are malnourished, the energy that is produced from the ATP systems is reduced. The ability of what's called our mitochondria, which are the little organelles sitting within the cell that generate the ATP, they are actually defective, and more recently we've shown how that defect occurs. And because these organelles are not producing ATP, the muscle is not able to contract and relax effectively. Also, you should recognize that resynthesis of muscle, that means building up the muscle mass, depends upon protein synthesis. And protein synthesis is very energy dependent. So that apart from improving function, if you have to improve the muscle mass, you have to have a better function of the mitochondria. So that, now coming back to your initial question, namely Rosenberg has pointed out that elderly people have sarcopenia, they have loss of muscle mass. In addition, they also have reduced muscle function. Nutrition is very important initially in improving function, and then on a longer-term basis, together with exercise, in actually increasing the mass. So that the importance of both function and structure or mass has to be emphasized in this context.
Well, you've really piqued my interest on so many levels now, and I guess my first follow-up question, we've talked a lot over the last 3 years about mitochondrial function and the mitochondrial genome and induced damage by oxidative injury to mitochondria and the effects it has on functional performance through oxidative phosphorylation. What did you find as it relates to the defect in mitochondria in these individuals?
Yeah, that's very interesting. We've just got a paper out in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. This is an animal study, but we have subsequently done this in humans, and we have another paper in preparation. And essentially what we have found is that when an animal is malnourished, even very marginally by just reducing their intake of food by about 20%, the mitochondrial complexes are reduced in activity. Just to put your listeners in perspective, what actually happens is within the cell there are little organelles called mitochondria. When your food is metabolized, the electrical charges of the food is passed along the number of units in the mitochondria, and energy is generated by charging the membrane of the mitochondria. It's almost like a little accumulator or battery. The electrons or the electrical charges flow along these little complexes. And what we found is that these complexes become less effective in transporting electrical charges with malnutrition. Not all the complexes. As a matter of fact, we found it's complex 1 and complex 2 and complex 3, but the complex 4 and 5 where ATP synthesis occurs is normal. However, even though they're normal, the electrons do not flow to the complex 4 and 5, and that's why there's a problem. What we further found was that protein feeding seemed to be particularly effective in restoring these complexes. Another more interesting thing we found was that not only were the muscle complexes or mitochondria reduced in activity, but so were they in the lymphocytes, which explains why individuals who are malnourished also tend to become more susceptible to infection. And in humans, we have used the lymphocyte measurements to look at the effects of fasting and feeding, and in fact, restoration of mitochondrial function by feeding.
Oh boy, this is fascinating work. With the electrons not flowing effectively to complex 3 and 4, but your ATP levels being okay, does that mean that there's some electron leakage, so to speak, with potential oxidative damage?
Yes, that's essentially, you're absolutely right about that, because as you know, the flow of electrons, when they are inhibited across the complexes, these electrons then leak and form the so-called free radicals, and the free radicals then can damage the mitochondria, which in turn can reduce the function. And I think basically you're absolutely right. That's probably what goes on. So that not only malnutrition might have an effect in reducing the flow of electrons, but also might increase damage to the mitochondria, which is one of the things we do notice.
Well, I remember it was a number of years ago, probably about 10 years ago, that you authored a paper that was published in Free Radicals in Biology and Medicine, I recall, and you talked about breath pentane as a measurement of functional oxidative stress.
Yes.
Do you feel that this would be an oxidative stress type situation that's occurring in these animals?
Yes, I think so. I think that not only is the complex is downregulated, but because of the block in electron flow, there would be added production of free radicals. At the moment, we are studying it at the mitochondrial level itself, but in humans, probably things like breath pentane, etc., might be used as a way of monitoring the same process in a less invasive fashion.
Then that begs the question, I guess, not only protein, but also antioxidants. I know that you've done quite a bit of work in the area of vitamin E and other antioxidants. Do you think there's a role that will be to play here as well?
Yes, I think there are two aspects to this. Antioxidants definitely are protective, but it turns out that what may be as effective or even more effective in terms of oxidative stress is to promote the flow of electrons so that you don't get this leak. The concept I'm coming down to is that we need to attack this process in two different ways. One way is by protecting the cell with antioxidants, and the ones that are particularly important are selenium and glutathione peroxidase and glutathione itself, as well as vitamin E. But on the other side, there might be benefit in actually promoting electron flow. That means improving ways by which the mitochondria function better. This is an area which has not been explored, and I suspect is going to be probably the new frontier in treating oxidative stress.
Well, that's fascinating. Let me, if I can, kind of switch the topic, because associated with oxidative stress, as you've shown us over the years, particularly in the gastrointestinal area, is the inflammatory condition. So we get into thinking about diseases like Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease. Can you tell us a little bit about, from your extensive research, how inflammatory mediators and oxidative stress play a role in the inflammatory conditions and what role nutrition may play there?
Well, inflammation ultimately acts through the process of so-called oxidative stress. I mean, after all, if you have to kill bacteria, most cells that we have that engulf bacteria and kill them do it by the process of oxidative stress. They produce free radicals, which then kill these bacteria. And similarly, T cells, when they kill tumor cells, they do it by the same process. So that oxidative stress, in that sense, is a positive thing. On the other hand, in situations where this process goes out of hand, like in the critically sick individual where initially there is increased oxidative stress to try and control the inflammation, but then if the bacteria then are killed, but the process remains uncontrolled, then of course the oxidative stress starts damaging the tissues locally, and you get into the so-called SIR syndrome, in which there is continued oxidative stress and continued inflammation, which actually becomes injurious and results in morbidity to the person. In the same way, in the gut, where the inflammatory bowel disease, there is, if you like to call it, a futile and excessive inflammatory reaction associated with increased oxidative stress. For example, a colleague of mine is working in this area, and she has found that if you give, say, iron by mouth to animals that have inflammatory bowel disease, this iron by mouth increases oxidative stress in the gut, and this in turn actually increases the injury to the bowel. So that in a situation where people have got bowel inflammation, nutrition might be great, but we might have to modify it so that the iron might have to go by a different route rather than by mouth. So there are a number of these very interesting interactions between nutrition and the gut. Also, there are certain fatty acids called the omega-3 fatty acids which have an anti-inflammatory effect, and increasing the intake of these omega-3 fatty acids might also be protective. In fact, they have shown to be protective in other inflammatory reactions such as rheumatoid arthritis, for example. And there's been some evidence that it does work well in colitis and in Crohn's disease. So that ways of delivering antioxidants to the inflamed area, and by modifying the diet, one, it might be possible to modulate a number of inflammatory conditions.
Recently, there's been more and more literature published on the reticular endothelial system of the gut, the so-called gut-associated lymphoid tissue or the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue, which seems to be an action point for many of these inflammatory processes that then also can produce systemic inflammatory mediators, increasing the concentration of these. Do you feel that what is emerging is the recognition that the gut is a principal organ, a kind of a signaling organ for the body related to these inflammatory-mediated related processes?
Well, the gut is extraordinarily complex in that there are bacteria which live in harmony with an immune system that is extremely active but in some ways downregulated. And the immune cells within the gut are actually not just static there, but they move through the thymus and they come back to the gut. So that the gut itself is a huge immune organ. And not only is it an immune organ, but it's exposed to a lot of stimuli in the form of bacteria. And in addition, when we eat food, we introduce a whole lot of other things in the bowel, which stimulates the immune system. So that there's no question that the gut is a very important area of not only local immunity, but also influencing immunity across the body. And this whole area of translocation of bacteria through the gut, which in itself might result in the injury to the liver and the heart and the systemic system in general. Translocation might be responsible for some of the more serious consequences of persons who are sick in ICUs. So that, yes, the gut is very important in that regard, and nutrients which might protect the lining of the gut or alter the lining of the gut might be very important in preventing disease of the rest of the body.
I notice that one of the things you're doing in your laboratories and your clinical work is a collaborative work with Dr. Soli on the effects of antioxidants on cardiac function, knowing that there is now this interconnection between gut endotoxinemia and cardiac dysfunction. Is this starting to show an interesting connection between the gut and the heart in some of these processes?
Well, that particular piece of research is going in a slightly different direction, but I think in answer to your question, we some years ago were very interested in looking at the effect of cytokines, particularly tumor necrosis factor, which is now known to be one of the mediators of systemic inflammation, and nutrition. And we noted that when this cytokine becomes active, then animals don't eat, they lose weight. And it's exactly what happens to people who get inflammation. And we thought, well, a good way of dealing with this would be to probably feed them so that their intake of food would not be reduced. And we did that. And when we did that, actually, we found that their inflammation actually became somewhat worse. But we did find there was a difference in the type of nutrients that we were giving them. If we gave them a lot of carbohydrates or fats, we found that the action of TNF was increased. But if we gave protein, it wasn't. So that it does appear to us that in the face of this kind of inflammatory reaction, modification of the diet to emphasize certain nutrients, not others, might be very important. Coming down to the work that I'm doing with Dr. Soul, what we have been doing is looking at cardiac failure. In that context, we did a controlled trial using vitamin E, which was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and we found that vitamin E failed actually to reduce the oxidative stress in the heart. But we did find that giving them components such as coenzyme Q and carnitine and taurine, which promote electron flow through the mitochondria, had a beneficial effect, increased the levels in the myocardium, and actually improved cardiac function. This has just appeared in the Canadian Journal of Cardiology, where we took animals with specific cardiomyopathies, and we showed that by giving this combination, we were able to reduce oxidative stress as well as improve ventricular function.
Well, this is fascinating. Once again, it shows the breadth of inquiries of an inquiring mind and a person who has the kind of vision that you have. As you look forward to where you think the field of clinical nutrition and its relationship to medicine is going, do you have any kind of sense as to what the horizon might look like?
Well, I think the area, the horizon should be, as far as I'm concerned, the term should be conditioned nutritional requirements. In other words, both genetics and disease, not only disease but environmental circumstances, I think, alter nutrition. Unfortunately, what's happened with our nutrition research is that people are trying to find one cap that fits everybody. Well, that's not going to happen. And I think our future research is going to be understanding the interaction of nutrition with genes on the one hand, with disease, infection, cancer, etc. on the other hand, and environmental factors on the third side. And I think it's only when we start to do that kind of research will we really see some, I suspect, some spectacular results.
Dr. Gigi Boy, this really, I think, points us all in directions for optimism in our future and how nutrition is going to play an ever-increasing role maybe in the way that we manage patients. I want to thank you for your years of contribution and great success as you move forward in your work. We're going to follow you very closely.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Taking the theme from Dr. Gigi Boy into the discussion of personalizing therapy and recognizing genomic uniqueness, I want to speak to one other risk factor that's a personalized risk factor that cuts across many different disease states. We've talked a little bit about the ApoE genotype, ApoE 2, 3, and 4. We've also talked about the hyperinsulinemia insulin resistance with regard to the 2-hour postprandial impaired glucose tolerance test, and it's as an individual risk factor, a functional risk factor. The third that I want to speak to is that of C-reactive protein, high sensitivity, CRP. This goes back to a discussion that we've had now for the last 2 years, but I want to really bring it to your attention for those of you that are forming individualized panels for your patients to look at relative risk that go across many age-related disease types, we would have to put C-reactive protein on that list. This is a paper that Dr. Paul Ridker from Harvard, who I've spoken about earlier in Functional Medicine Update, is the principal author, a cardiology professor from Harvard Medical School. This is from the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 285, page 2481, entitled Novel Risk Factors for Systemic Atherosclerosis, a comparison of C-reactive protein, fibrinogen, homocysteine, lipoprotein A, and standard cholesterol screening as predictors of peripheral arterial disease. And in this particular study, they first did a univariate and then a multivariate analysis of these different risk factors. In univariate analyses, plasma levels of total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and ApoE and triglycerides were all very, very high predictors, with a P001 or less significant level, whereas fibrinogen was significant at P02 level. CRP, however, was also highly significant, C-reactive protein high sensitivity, at a P006 level, and a total cholesterol HDL ratio probably being the most sensitive of all, less than P001 level. However, when we did a multivariate analysis, putting them together, we found that the total cholesterol HDL ratio and the combination with the CRP led to a very strong predictor for relative risk to peripheral arterial disease. In assessing the joint effects, then, the addition of CRP to standard lipid screening significantly improved risk prediction models based on lipid screening alone at the less than P001 level, according to this paper. So of the 11 atherothrombotic markers that were assessed, the use of the cholesterol HDL ratio in combination with an algorithm that includes high sensitivity CRP gave the best prediction. Well, are we ready then to go prime time with CRP to be added to the panels? And that's a very interesting question. An editorial recently in Clinical Chemistry, volume 47, page 9 in 2001, reminded us that C-reactive protein is an exquisitely sensitive marker of systemic inflammation and has emerged as a powerful predictor of cardiovascular disease. The availability of this high-sensitivity assay has enabled the detection of even low-grade inflammatory responses that might have previously been regarded as clinically not meaningful. The use of the algorithm, which is the HDL cholesterol to total cholesterol algorithm in combination with CRP, provides the most powerful predictor that has been identified to date. And this is, again, seen in another paper by Dr. Ridker entitled High Sensitivity CRP, A Novel and Promising Marker of Coronary Heart Disease in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 47, page 403, and a follow-up looking at the evaluation of 9 automated high-sensitivity C-reactive protein methods and the implication for clinical and epidemiological applications. This, again, is Clinical Chemistry, Volume 47, page 418, showing that you could get methodology in the routine clinical laboratory to give good numbers, reproducible, sensitive, precise numbers. Compared with a variety of other inflammatory markers and lipid variables, CRP turned out to be the best predictor for future coronary events and was actually better than elevated homocysteine. However, the authors point out that the C-reactive protein must be regarded primarily as a surrogate marker for the cytokine-mediated inflammatory disorders, and there is a sound experimental and pathological basis that these molecules may also be directly involved in various processes of atherosclerosis, but that evidence is still emerging, so we would probably call them more surrogate than primary markers. However, there is evidence that one would not want to employ C-reactive protein in all traditional risk factor panels unless you were doing a functional medicine-based practice, trying to really personalize rather than a public health type of approach towards your patient. We do know that elevated C-reactive protein concentrations, high-sensitivity CRPs, are associated with angiographic evidence of coronary lesions. This is a more recent paper, again in Clinical Chemistry, page 47, page 882 in the year 2001, and among patients with suspected coronary artery disease undergoing coronary angiographic evaluation, it was found that increased CRP was strongly associated with unstable angina and with specific high-risk features associated with the culprit of these coronary lesions. So there is a pathognomonic association with CRP, but what we really talk about is more of a functional marker for individualized risk to inflammatory disorders, of which coronary artery disease is one. So how about rheumatology? Because we cut across from cardiology to rheumatology with CRP, and as you know, CRP is an old colleague of the rheumatologist, having been employed since the 1950s as a laboratory marker of the inflammatory response. CRP was discovered more than 70 years ago in the blood of patients with pneumococcal pneumonia. It arose very early within the first few days of infection and preceded the specific antibody response by a week or more. CRP is known to react with C polysaccharide of the pneumococcal bacterial cell wall, hence got its name as C-reactive protein. It's a member of the pentraxin family of proteins. It's analogous to the interaction of antibody with antigen. CRP binds to the repeating bacterial polysaccharides and activates the classical complement pathway. In this process, C4 and C3 complement fragments deposit on bacteria. Adherence and phagocytosis are thereby facilitated through receptors on leukocytes. And then for CRP and complement fragments, it activates this adherence and phagocytotic process. Purified human CRP, when injected into mice, protects them from lethal consequences of pneumococcal infection, suggesting that it is a therapeutic agent that the body produces or a biological response agent that helps in disease management. Rheumatologists are especially familiar with CRP because its concentration increase, sometimes dramatically so, secondary to enhanced hepatic synthesis during times of many inflammatory conditions. It's a marker of the ongoing response. It is tied together with the erythrocyte sedimentation rate as the two workhorses utilized by a rheumatologist to monitor inflammatory response. It now seems that complement activation, especially in the synovial fluid, but also in the serum, has been repeatedly shown in rheumatoid arthritis, and that immune complexes interacting with rheumatoid factors have been proposed to be the pathophysiological mechanism, and that CRP may play a role in trying to modify these immune complexes and complement and oxidative stress-related reactions. The novel and exciting possibility that has been raised in a paper that actually appeared in Arthritis and Rheumatism, this is a Molinar study entitled Complement Activation in Patients with Rheumatoid Arthritis Mediated in Part by C-Reactive Protein, Volume 44, page 997 in the year 2001, indicates that CRP is playing a fundamental role in the pathophysiology of rheumatoid arthritis by putting a brake on the inflammatory condition. So how do we fit all these pieces together? On one hand, innate immunity associated with CRP release mediates tissue injury in rheumatoid arthritis. On the other hand, defects in the innate immune system may be the etiological factor and or trigger of autoimmunity in some patients, and that CRP may play a principal role as both a marker and a modulator of this process. We recognize now that the CRP connection may also be triggered through aspects of immunological upregulation that are associated with the gut, because we see increased activation of the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. And therefore, we come back to what Dr. Gigi Boy was sharing with us earlier about the gut as an important modulator of function of the immune system. It was very intriguing to see in Nature Medicine, Volume 7, page 537 in the year 2001, a paper entitled Vasoactive Intestinal Peptide Preventing Experimental Arthritis by Downregulating Both Autoimmune and Inflammatory Components of the Disease. How could a neuromodulating hormone from the hypothalamus ultimately influence gut function? Because we know the gut is a brain and the brain is a gut, and they share these interesting feedback processes. Rheumatoid arthritis, the most common inflammatory arthritis, affects about 1% of the adults. And the disease, as you know, is normally marked by synovial inflammation and hyperplasia in the small joints and hands and feet. And we see things that are released as inflammatory mediators associated with the disease, like TH1 cytokines, the tumor necrosis factor alpha, and interleukin-1. In this paper in the recent issue of Nature Medicine, Delgado et al. Showed that the administration of vasoactive intestinal peptide to an animal model of rheumatoid arthritis suppressed inflammatory arthritis and downregulated the production of TNF-alpha and IL-1. Low levels of TH1 cytokines such as INF interferon and IL-17 have been identified in the synovium of patients with rheumatoid arthritis, whereas the TH2 cytokines are nearly absent, the anti-inflammatory cytokines, and the TNF-alpha and IL-1 are elevated. So there's an imbalance between TH1 and TH2 with a preponderance of TH1 expressed immune modulators. Enhancement of the TH2 function, therefore, and a downregulation of TH1 has been proposed as a therapeutic approach to rheumatoid arthritis, and that's seemingly what administration of vasoactive intestinal peptide was able to do in this animal model, is to lower TH1 and elevate TH2 to provide the balance. So there is something about gut hormones, gut function, neuromodulation of gut function that may play a role. It may also tell us why some people are more susceptible to infections than others and why we get this genotypic susceptibility. Many other genetically determined variations, as we know, are kind of sublethal in the immune system, the so-called histocompatibility system, the HLA system, human leukocyte antigen system. Many individual components of the immune system are highly polymorphic. Polymorphisms and variant forms of genes occur at least 1% of the population. And this polymorphism of the HLA system makes each person relatively unique in the terms of tissue type and immunological interactions that may then lead to various susceptibility factors. So are normal individuals, therefore, showing a range of different susceptibilities? And how then could this relate to people in a practice of medicine which are coming back with more and more recurrent infections? Are these the yellow canary, so to speak? Well, this was discussed in a recent editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 285, page 1348, in 2001, that came to the conclusion that the interaction of various organisms with the unique immunological system of the individual that are varied in their HLA response can then lead to differing degrees of signaling of inflammation, and that the gut plays a very important role in this signaling. Why we don't get sick, the within-host population dynamics of bacterial infections, is the article of Bruce Levin and Rustam Anshia that recently was published in Science Magazine, Volume 292, page 1112, that talks about commensal-host bacterial relationships in the gut, a similar topic that was described by Laura Hooper and Jeffrey Gordon in their paper in Science Magazine, Volume 292, page 1115, 2001. The outcome of adaptive coevolution of humans and bacteria in the development of commensal or symbiotic or parasitic relationships, which then the gastrointestinal tract being colonized by a vast community of symbiotes and commensals, having important effects on immune function, nutrient processing, and a broad range of other host activities. The current genomic revolution that we've been speaking to in Functional Medicine Update for the past 2 years offers an unprecedented opportunity to identify the molecular foundations of these relationships, so we can see how the flora of the gut communicate with the receptor sites on the gut that then activate the immune system. A very, very interesting article, and one that talks about establishing microbial communities in different regions of the gastrointestinal tract and using prebiotics and probiotics of the right type to signal the right messages. The ultimate therapeutic reduction of the symbiote host or commensal host relationship will be then the identification of microbial products that affect processes disordered in the immune system of that individual that lead to increased prevalency of disease. Identifying such microbial signals will be challenging, but we're already seeing some very significant breakthroughs with published papers like the use of probiotics in the primary prevention of atopic disease in women who give birth to children and who have supplemented prior to delivery with probiotics, and then the children become immunized against atopic disorders after birth. This is a very powerful study, Lancet, Volume 357, page 1076, in which the women 2 months before birth started supplementing with a capsule form of lactobacillus that was then capable of colonizing their gut with friendly bacteria and sending a different message to the fetus as it relates to their developing immune system. I think you can see we're standing at a threshold of a tremendous medicine where the environment and its modification plays a significant role in the manipulation of the gene and its expression that gives rise to the prevention of age-related diseases. This is not just hand-waving and smoke. This is today's medicine that can be applied in the personalized form of functional medicine. We'll look forward to seeing you in September. Thanks very much.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, Incorporated, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.